Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hong Kong has lived on the edge of empire, British and Chinese, providing services and capabilities to powerful nations, enriching its elite in the process. And the one country, two systems policy has obviously dominated Hong Kong for some years and for a period reflected Beijing's need for Hong Kong to provide China with access to world markets, especially financial ones. But now, is one country, two systems over because the Chinese no longer have those uses for Hong Kong? Well, Ho Fung-hung is professor in political economy at Johns Hopkins University. He's written a book, City on the Edge, Hong Kong Under Chinese Rule, which describes the history of Hong Kong right from the beginning, but particularly concentrates on what's happened with the protests there and the whole idea of one country, two systems and where it's headed. So, first of all, Professor, thanks very much for talking to us.
Thank you for having me.
And let's just go right back to the beginning of Hong Kong. Can you tell us what was there before the British turned up?
Hong Kong has been sitting on the border of two tectonic plates, and it is the metaphor I use throughout the books. One is a kind of a continental power based on the landmass of the Chinese Empire. So, and the other tectonic plate is the kind of a maritime world of commerce. So even before the British came in the 1840s, as my book narrative started in the 12th century, that Hong Kong is already at the edge of the maritime world with a lot of fishing activities and maritime trade. It is sitting on the mouth of the Pearl River Delta. So before Western colonialism, there was Arab traders and traders from South Asia and also Chinese seafaring traders as well coming to and from Guangzhou or Canton through Hong Kong. So Hong Kong has been sitting on this kind of border between the continental land power of the Chinese Empire and the maritime world since at least the 12th century.
One of the interesting things that came out of the book for me was that the families who were running the quite poor boating services, if you like, fishing and moving stuff around, yes, in Hong Kong before the British arrived, were transformed into very important people because they provided shipping services to the British as they came in. And then some of those people went on to become the big families of Hong Kong and part of the elite.
Yes, exactly. The Hong Kong, the cliché is that Hong Kong was a fishing village, which has some truth in it. So there's a lot of these Tang Ka fishermen settling along the shore of Hong Kong and actually South China in general for hundreds, if not thousands of years. And they are poor. And then when the British came, many landed elite in pre-colonial Hong Kong was resistant to foreign rules. And then the British sought collaborators among the marginalized people. And the Tang Ka fishermen who were marginalized by the landed population in Hong Kong were happy to collaborate with of the British as a kind of providing transporting service, shipping the cargoes from the big ships to the shore and running warehouse. And some of them become important merchants. And later, as I outlined, it became some of the big tycoons in colonial Hong Kong and become sympathetic to the PRC. And then after 1997, one of them, particularly the Henry Ford family, became a kingmaker in the post handover political system.
Yeah, so in that way, they reflect the history of Hong Kong from poor fishing village to the British period and now the Chinese being predominant. But can you just tell us a bit more about, I mean, everywhere they ran colonies, the British ruled through local elites. How did that happen in Hong Kong? What did that look like?
Yeah, there's the urban part and the rural part. In the urban part, definitely since the 19th century, and particularly after the Second World War and after the communist takeover, there were a lot of Chinese mercantile elite and industrial elite migrated to Hong Kong. And so the British colonial power, like the British colonial rule in many other places, that they cannot establish direct intervention in the society, so they rely on co-opting local elites. Of course, it includes the European elites, the big Jewish family, the big British merchant house of some of them, and also some Chinese elites. First of all, it is this mercantile and banking families, and later on, after the Second World War, there came the industrial elite that originated from Shanghai, and shipping families like the Dong Qihua families are one of them. So after they arrive in Hong Kong, they also start to be integrated in the power system under British rule. So they are the urban elite, European and Chinese, that collaborate with the British government to govern Hong Kong. And the British colonial government actually in Hong Kong enjoyed some autonomy from London and from time. And again, that we see in the post-war period that the British colonial government often try to advance the interests of Hong Kong. And even at the point of arguing with or sometimes fighting with the London government, who might have some other thought about Hong Kong. So Hong Kong has been quite an autonomous city state, even in the colonial period, and based on a synergy between the British officials and the British, European and the Chinese business elite.
Now, one of the key moments in the history of Hong Kong was when the communists took over China, and they could have taken over Hong Kong as well. But one of the points your book makes is that they didn't, because they chose not to. And that was because Hong Kong was providing services to the Chinese government, even through the Cultural Revolution and everything. So just spell out for us, why would China prefer at that time Hong Kong to be under British rule?
Even at the height of Cold War, before Nixon visited China, and in the 50s and 60s, then China really relied on Hong Kong as a window to get access to capital and supply. For example, during the Korean War, there was an international embargo on the PRC, and then Hong Kong became a kind of transshipment center in which a lot of smuggling going on, that the tanker family, the Henry Ford, that I mentioned before, that they basically thrive in the 1950s, early 1950s, by shipping strategic supplies, including medical supplies, some military hardware, smuggling into PRC to defy the embargo. So it is this kind of shipment of supply that PRC desperately need through Hong Kong, and also capital, because cut off from the world economy, and China still need to have hard currency to purchase capital goods and machines from the world. And it's all through Hong Kong. And Hong Kong has been the only source of foreign currency for the PRC at the height of the Cold War, as many Chinese migrants in Hong Kong send remittance back home. And also the PRC maintained the banks and merchant business companies in Hong Kong to do business. Also, they sell, actually, in the early 1960s, China and South China, Guangdong province, start to sell drinking fresh water to Hong Kong. And it is one very important source of foreign currency for China, that China in turn used to purchase capital goods and all other kind of strategic supplies via Hong Kong. So Hong Kong has been very important, provide the only window that China can have access to the world under the international embargo. Even after Nixon visited China, that China also continued to rely on Hong Kong as a kind of middleman or entry port interface with the world.
Yeah, I mean, I'd never realized that Hong Kong had separate membership of the World Trade Organization. I mean, that illustrates the point perfectly, you know, quite independent of China. So clearly, goods and services could move through Hong Kong in a way that they couldn't go direct to China.
Yes, even after 1997, even after China entered the WTO, that the fact that Hong Kong is an independent and separate member, so in the WTO from the PRC under different conditions and terms, is very important. Finance is the most important, even to today, because China, for economic and political security reasons, never interested in opening up its financial system. So foreign banks cannot actually directly and fully do business in China, but Chinese company and Chinese wealthy people still need to have access to global finance. So the solution is to maintain a window in Hong Kong. So the foreign banks, international banks who want to do business with Chinese companies and Chinese wealthy people, while they cannot do it directly and fully in mainland China, can do it directly and fully in Hong Kong. So Beijing actually, through Hong Kong, had the best of both worlds. First, that they can shield off their financial system from foreign participation, but at the same time, they can enjoy access to international finance through Hong Kong.
Yes, it reminded me of the situation of Switzerland in the Second World War, when Nazi Germany allowed the Swiss to remain an independent country, a neutral country, but clearly could have overrun Switzerland, but didn't, because the Swiss banking services were useful to Nazi Germany.
Yes, indeed. It is very much a similar dynamics.
So then take us forward to more recent times when Hong Kong was providing other services to the Chinese leadership. For instance, allowing senior politicians in China to get residency in Hong Kong for their children and allowing the children to move more easily internationally.
Indeed, if you are in China, you are elite, you are a leader, if you have a lot of money, that is relatively or very difficult to move your wealth out of China without being noticed by the government and even not allowed in many cases, it's very difficult. So what they do is that they establish themselves or their families, a close family, wife or children, to establish residency in Hong Kong and then buy property in Hong Kong, because once money moved from mainland China to Hong Kong, you can move the money from Hong Kong to anywhere else in the world freely and without being noticed by Beijing, by the authorities. So a lot of wealthy elite would use Hong Kong as a kind of offshore station for them to store their wealth. It is why Hong Kong, not only the banking, insurance, and financial sector, but even like the art gallery auctions and red wine auction house, they are very, very prosperous because of this kind of elite of the Chinese elite to store their wealth in Hong Kong.
So has any of this changed? I mean, that's the interesting thing. You've got this whole period where, you know, Hong Kong was allowed to exist in the way it did because it basically served Beijing's purpose. Has that now changed? Does the Chinese Communist Party and the senior politicians there have less need of Hong Kong than they used to?
Actually, it is a very interesting question, and it is not yet a settled issue, because the existence of Hong Kong, on the one hand, serves Beijing, Chinese national development, and serves the financial lead of the Chinese elite very much, but at the same time, it constitutes a threat. On the one hand, that the lead that Hong Kong serves cannot be easily replaced by any financial center in mainland China, Shanghai or Shenzhen. They keep talking about developing Shanghai and Shenzhen as a free trade zone that can replace and outcompete Hong Kong. But they talk about it for 20 years and nothing happened in all these other financial centers because they are a lot offshore. They don't, like Shanghai or Shenzhen, they didn't have a separate currency which is freely convertible with the US dollar. They don't have totally porous financial border with the world economy and many other institutional framework like the court in common law tradition and things like that, and didn't exceed. So even they tried to start a Shanghai free trade zone, but the international banks are not very interested in moving there, and they tried in Shanghai and Shenzhen to do the same thing, to establish a free trade zone to attract business from Hong Kong to there. And international business and even Chinese financial firms are not interested in doing the business in place of Hong Kong. So Hong Kong is irreplaceable in its status as an offshore financial center. So it has a very unique role, but at the same time, it constitutes a threat to China because the analogy between Hong Kong and Switzerland under the influence of Nazi Germany is very well, except that Switzerland was a sovereign country and Nazi Germany didn't need to worry about Switzerland influencing the politics and threatening the regime in Nazi Germany. But Hong Kong is nominally part of China and a free society within the PRC sovereignty constitutes a threat to mainland China and the communist regime with all these kind of June 4th candlelight vigils and all these protests. And they really worry that the freedom in Hong Kong will spill over to mainland China. So it is a dilemma. On the one hand, they have this lead to maintain a free society and offshore financial center in Hong Kong. But at the same time, this freedom create a space for possible challenge to the CCP rule. And so what happened in 2019 and what is unique about the 2019 protests in comparison to, for example, the 2014 protests is that there's evidence that I show in my book that at least there's elite sympathy to the protesters among the Hong Kong local financial elite and even some mainland Chinese elite in Hong Kong, because the impetus that gave rise to the protest is to protest against this extradition bill that can allow the Chinese security people to arrest and transfer the people in Hong Kong to mainland China to be tried in the mainland Chinese court system. So it scare many rich people, including Chinese rich people in Hong Kong. So there's a lot of indication that even the elites are starting to be at least sympathetic to the rebels, and if not outright rebellious. So it is why the Chinese government need to crack down in full force and even revamp the political system through this national security law totally, because they worry about this kind of rebellion in Hong Kong is no longer restricted to the lower and middle class, but also spreading to the elites. So if there's a kind of alliance of elite and the popular classes formed, and it will really be kind of, from the perspective of Beijing, a color revolution, that the local government of Hong Kong will be taken over by somebody not totally controllable by Beijing. So it's why they crack down hard. And after they crack down hard, they're still in two minds about how far to go. That under national security law, of course, the civil society is already eradicated mostly, that many organizations, student organizations, NGOs are already outlawed, or people are arrested or escaped it. But at the same time, they don't know how far to crack down on the financial elite. There's two examples that happened very recently, is that I don't have the opportunity to include in the book, but it is very important to show the fact that Hong Kong, the conflict over Hong Kong is not over. One is...
Tell you what, we'll get onto that in a moment, and I'd be interested to hear about those two cases. But just before then, I think it would help, first of all, just to spell out what you said there about the issue on which the student protesters and the elite may have had common cause, was this idea that you could commit a crime in Hong Kong and be extradited to be, or moved to be tried in China itself. And that became the key test, really, of one country, two systems. And before we got onto the protests and this latest news you've got for us, I just thought it'd be useful to spell out one country, two systems, because one of the points you're making, which is interesting, is that the model had been used, and actually it had failed in Tibet and arguably in Taiwan. So can you tell us, first of all, about the Chinese idea of one country, two systems in Tibet?
Yeah, in the 1950s, that China established a 17-point agreement with the Dalai Lama government. According to the agreement, that the Tibetan elite, the Dalai Lama government, recognized the PRC sovereignty over Tibet. In exchange, the Dalai Lama government can continue to govern Tibet and take care of all internal affairs, and the PRC only take care of external affairs, foreign affairs, and even the Dalai Lama government can maintain their own very minimal military establishment of the Tibetan government in Lhasa. So it is exactly a one country, two system without being called a one country, two system. But of course, that Tibet at the time, a lot like Hong Kong, it didn't play a kind of a role as an offshore financial center. The reason why the PRC established a one country, two system with the Dalai Lama government simply to buy time, because in the Tibetan plateau, that without kind of a highway and reasonable transportation network linking the mainland China with Tibet, so it is very difficult to send all the military, the PLA, to govern. So they need to buy time to build the highway connecting Lhasa to mainland China. And after that is done, that they really continue to expand the direct control of Tibet and invoke a rebellion in 1959. And then the rest is history, that there's a full-scale direct control and the Dalai Lama free, and Tibet turned from one country, two system to a one country, one system after the 1959 uprising. And Deng Xiaoping in early 1980s even recurrently talk about 1950s Tibet is a kind of quite successful experiment of one country, two system, and he blamed Dalai Lama for its failure.
Right, so that you're quite clear in that case that it was a cynical measure by the, or tactic, by the Beijing leadership to buy time, one country, two systems, before they could impose one country, one system. So now take us through your interpretation of the use of the one country, two system idea in relation to Taiwan.
Yes. In Taiwan, of course, it's very different that Taiwan has a full support by the U.S. under the Taiwan Relations Act because it has some kind of a power of dependence about how PRC and U.S. established diplomatic relations. Before 1979, when PRC and the U.S. established diplomatic relations, U.S. has a formal diplomatic relation with the Republic of China in Taiwan. So when they U.S. Shift the recognition to the PRC in 1979, that it also instituted a Taiwan Relations Act that show U.S. continuous commitment to defend Taiwan. So Taiwan has this kind of U.S. protection, and also U.S. See Taiwan as a very important strategic place. So Taiwan were offered one country, two system actually from the 1960s, that Mao Zedong and Zhou Enlai already suggest this kind of one country, two system arrangement to Taiwan and is today. But they are not interested. They don't need to entertain it because they have their continuous backing of the U.S. And also it is more difficult now because Taiwan is a fully democratic society. They have their full election of their legislature and their presidents and the free press and a very vibrant democracy. So it's a lot like Hong Kong is a liberal society, but it's not a fully democratic society before the handover. So from a Taiwan perspective, it is much more difficult for the people in Taiwan to accept this kind of a one country, two system arrangement.
Right, but it's easier in Hong Kong. Now, is it your view that one country, two systems is now over? You know, that the Chinese have done enough to effectively mean they've got complete control of Hong Kong, or is it still an open question?
Yes, that it come back to this tourist example in recent months is that and on one wing of the CCP, of course, see that this one country, and they write about it and they talk about it that I cite in my book, that explicitly that one country, two system is just to buy times. And then now, just like in Tibet, now the time is ripe. They can establish full control of Hong Kong, which is true in the sense that they have already established full control of Hong Kong now after eradicating all these liberal newspaper and opposition groups and parties and in terms of civil society and politics that they have established full control. But what they are not sure yet is about how far to go to put Hong Kong's status as an offshore financial center in jeopardy, that after the national security law that Beijing have been talking about applying the anti-foreign sanction laws that is already effective in mainland China to Hong Kong early last year. And if it was applied to Hong Kong, it has dire consequence to the financial sector, because under the anti-foreign sanction laws, financial institutions and any companies in Hong Kong cannot follow sanctions established by US or UK or other foreign government. If they follow those sanctions against officials and individuals or companies, they will be violating Chinese law. So any financial firms, banks in Hong Kong will be forced to choose between abiding by US, UK law or law in anywhere else in the world and Chinese law. So they will be in a very difficult position. They are either violating Chinese law or US, UK law when it comes to this sanction issue. So if they really apply that anti-foreign sanction law in Hong Kong, it will be forcing a lot of banks actually to leave Hong Kong, that they find it is impossible to abide by the law of both sides at the same time. But then there's a lobby by banking sector in Hong Kong, including Chinese bank reportedly in Hong Kong, saying that it will destroy Hong Kong offshore financial center status. It will be a huge impact on the business environment in Hong Kong. In the end, that at the last minute, in last summer, that Beijing declared that they are going to suspend and continue to study whether to or how to apply this anti-foreign sanction law in Hong Kong, so that it create a space for financial institutions to continue to abide by US and Europe and UK sanction against Chinese officials without violating Chinese law. So it's one example that they're still cautious about how far to go to destroy Hong Kong uniqueness to the point of jeopardizing Hong Kong status as an offshore financial center. And another example is, of course, the COVID control measure. Early, they are talking about Hong Kong has to follow this strict COVID zero COVID policy to have a universal lockdown and to have universal testing, like what Shanghai is undergoing now. But again, that these bond firms and banks and all these people are very anxious about this kind of a lockdown impact on the financial center. In the end, that they didn't do it. So Hong Kong narrowly escaped the fate of Shanghai. And on the other hand, that they are loosening border control regarding foreign visitors and things like that. So this kind of a concern about Hong Kong financial centrality is still in the mind of the Chinese leaders, so much so that they are not ready to go full force to make Hong Kong exactly doing the same thing as, for example, in terms of COVID policy that Shanghai did. So it showed that it's still not yet a settled issue about how far to crack down on Hong Kong and to destroy Hong Kong offshore financial center's status.
Right. Look, I wonder if we could just put this in the context of China's imperial policy, if you like. One of the striking sentences in your book is that China is an empire trying to be a nation state. And I think if I understood you correctly, the history of Chinese imperialism within its own, what is now within what is now China's borders, is that compared to some imperial systems that allow a lot of leeway to local cultures, local rulers, and some sort of local autonomy, China has never done it that way. It wants control, right? So this situation that Hong Kong is in now is an anomaly within the Chinese tradition. Is that right?
First, that China is an empire pretending to be a nation state. I cite somebody else who talked about it, and it is quite obvious now. And some people said that, oh, it might not be right to call Chinese an empire or talk about Chinese imperialism. But ironically, that many Chinese official scholars and prominent intellectuals within the establishment of the PRC, they do talk about China as an empire, as a kind of they're proud of it, actually, that they use the word empire in a positive way. They talk about the fact that we have the Roman Empire, we have the British Empire, we have the American Empire. Now it is trying to turn to become an empire. So they are not shy from acknowledging that China has an imperial, is an imperial power. And China has this imperial tradition, as I talk about in the book, that and the Chinese leader and official textbooks and explicitly talk about it, is that in the Qing Empire in the 18th century, that they incorporate all these areas with non-Han and non-ethnic minority. And so in the beginning, that they allow them local autonomy, the local native chieftain can exercise local control. But when the time came through immigration of Han migrant in this area, and also when the time became mature, that they just establish direct rule and got rid of the local chieftain and the local elite, and then assimilate the area, and then they move on to another farther away area. So what China do is like that Hong Kong is the first stop, that they incorporate a kind of a culturally, politically, and socially framed different entity from mainland China, and then they assimilate it and then establish direct rule. After that, they move on to somewhere else, and definitely then Taiwan is the next target. And some ultra-nationalist writer in China is already writing, and the people take it as a joke, but I always think that we need to take it more seriously than people did. As that, to talk about this kind of next 10, 50 years, how China can revive its glory, that some ultra-nationalist writer is talking about Hong Kong, Taiwan, and then Okinawa even, that because the Okinawa is the old Ryukyu kingdom, was a kind of a triple state of the Chinese Empire before it was incorporated by Japan. So they are already talking about this kind of continuous expansion in this overseas entity. So that definitely is a kind of imperial ambition there, and is tied to the revival, the so-called Great Revival of the Chinese civilization.
Well, you've very clearly described some Hong Kong history and this very difficult relationship with China. In the last few years, let's say particularly 2019, Hong Kong saw these massive protests. which is what sparked the end of One Country, Two Systems. Can you explain those protests to us in terms of the relationship with China, which I guess is pretty obvious, that Hong Kong was asking for liberties to preserve liberties they felt they had, but also the parallels with South Korea and Taiwan, where there are also protests. What I'm really asking is, were the Hong Kong protests at all like the ones in South Korea and Taiwan?
The Hong Kong protest is very much inspired by Taiwan, because Taiwan faced the same great power, which is the PRC, that tried to incorporate the society and even eradicated the local democracy. So the concern of many Taiwan protesters, even though there's driven a lot of internal issues in Taiwan, but it's always linked to this kind of who are the collaborator of the PRC who try to seize control of Taiwan and who are not. So Hong Kong protest is very much inspired and connected to Taiwan protests. But of course, Hong Kong protest has this specific agenda. The 2019 protests is the most confrontational and widespread mobilization in Hong Kong history. And 2014 is another one. But the protest, the target is very different. In 2014, the protest is triggered by the failed promise of full democracy in Hong Kong, because one of the key elements that PRC of Beijing tried to convince the international community and the British government and also Hong Kong people to accept sovereignty, handover to China, is that Beijing promised in the end that the Hong Kong local government will have universal suffrage, will have elections to elect. Hong Kong people will elect their own leaders and their own legislators. So it was the promise was in the Sino-British Joint Declaration, 1984, and it was in the Basic Law, that is the mini constitution endorsed by the Chinese government to govern Hong Kong after 1997. So people expecting this kind of a universal suffrage after 1997, and many of the protests is to ask for a speedier and implementation of this of a genuine universal suffrage. So the trigger of the protest in 2014 is that Beijing said that, yeah, you have universal suffrage. You can vote who is your chief executive, but we are going to control the candidates. We are going to pick the candidates for you to vote for. So then many people think that it is not really a genuine universal suffrage. It's just like an Iranian kind of election or the village election in China, that the party pick the candidates and then people can vote which party candidates. They can vote sometimes only one candidate. So people protest in 2014 to ask for genuine universal suffrage. So it is asking for the fulfillment of a promise that they failed to deliver. So it's 2014. And 2019 target is a more defensive protest, because, as I said, it was triggered by this extradition bill that allowed Hong Kong police and Chinese security forces to actually arrest people in Hong Kong and transfer them to Chinese court, to the PRC. So it is a kind of encroachment into existing autonomy and liberty of Hong Kong people. And because before this extradition bill, there's a lot of reports about this kind of a cross-border kidnapping of Chinese tycoons and booksellers. But they do it, or reportedly they did it in a kind of more kind of a under the radar secretive way. But after the extradition bill, people will expect that they can all do it out in the open, and more will be happening. So actually that this kind of a protest is a kind of a defending some existing liberty and even legal protection under the common law in the Hong Kong court system. And so it is very different from the 2014. In the 2014, the Democrat, the opposition, the grassroots and the middle class are asking for full democracy, but the business elite are not impressed. They are actually that coming out to denounce the protester, and they are firmly in alliance with the Beijing in denouncing the protests in 2014. But in 2019, the business elite actually were the first to come out to voice their concern and even opposition to this extradition bill, because there's a lot of cases in which the Hong Kong business elite getting into trouble with their business partner or local government in China. They get warned or detained and they escape and get back to Hong Kong. But if this extradition bill became a reality, they can arrest them and transfer them to mainland China. So the business elite are threatened and they're anxious. So they are establishing an alliance, kind of, or in, at least in a sympathetic relation with the protesters. So it's why the protest in 2019 is so huge, because many people think that it is an existential crisis of Hong Kong.
Yeah. So if I understand you correctly, the if you take South Korea, for example, the students were basically asking for democratic reform there on the streets for many years. And that was not so dissimilar to 2014 in Hong Kong. But
yes.
2019 was more of a specific issue in relation to Chinese power.
It is taking away a fundamental freedom of Hong Kong and the rule of law of Hong Kong that Hong Kong people enjoyed it since the colonial times, actually in the 1970s and 1980s, particularly after the colonial reform in the 1970s. And Hong Kong is not a democratic entity, but it was a free society. And people are seeing that being threatened fundamentally by the extradition bill in 2019.
Now, one of the most fascinating things about Hong Kong is, you know, it's almost an experiment in political culture and how long it takes to form a political culture, which is all sort of encompassed by the question, to what extent does Hong Kong have a genuinely separate identity and culture to the rest of China?
It is a very interesting question, because there have been a lot of discussion and scholarly research on Hong Kong cultural identities, and many people see the rise of the Cantonese pop song in the 1970s as one key indicator of this Hong Kong separate identity, and the use of vernacular language, because before the 1970s, most of the pop song is English or Mandarin Chinese. And so there's a lot of talk about this cultural identity, but this kind of a cultural identity is just cultural identity. In terms of political identity, many Hong Kong people, including the opposition, that they are Chinese nationalists. So it is why the democratic movement in the 80s and 90s that they have been supporting Hong Kong returning to China, and then they are seeing Hong Kong democratic movement just an appendix or a part of Chinese democratic movement, and the ultimate goal is not only autonomy and democracy of Hong Kong, but a democracy of the whole China. So they are Chinese nationalists. What happened is that after the handover, a new generation grow up, which is different from the older generation, who has a lot of connection with mainland China in terms of their family ties, in terms of the resentment against British colonial rule, if you will. But the new generation grew up in a time when they don't have this kind of resentment against the British colonialism, and comparatively speaking, they feel British the late colonial period Hong Kong see more freedom than after 1997, when a lot of kind of a control and censorship, self censorship of the media start to expand. So they start, this new generation start to develop Hong Kong as a separate political identity. That and then a lot of this kind of a research and survey opinion pool asks about people identification show that after the Beijing Olympics, particularly in 2008, that the Hong Kong identity become stronger and stronger, and Chinese identity become weaker and weaker. And particularly among the young people, they really see Hong Kong as a very, very separate, not only a cultural entity, but also even a political community. So that they start to think that Hong Kong future, Hong Kong political system should be determined by referendum, local referendum. And so it is the support of self-determination of Hong Kong, about Hong Kong future after the one country, two system set to expire in 2047. So it's a very different landscape. And this kind of identity, a political identity of Hong Kong once established, it is very difficult to get rid of from a Beijing perspective, even through draconian repression.
I mean, it's very interesting to hear your account of Hong Kong, but just thinking in terms of its importance to the world, I guess, you know, what happens is important to the people of Hong Kong, it's important to Beijing, but when it comes to the rest of the world, it's really Taiwan that matters, isn't it? Not now, it's not Hong Kong, really.
Not only Taiwan, I would say even further afield, because one of the key official scholar, which is the smartest, most sophisticated establishment scholar now, the head of social science at Peking University that Jiang Zigong I keep citing, is very interesting that he explicitly talk about in his book that Hong Kong is important to Beijing in the sense that because the British left a lot of the Western institutions in Hong Kong, political, legal, social institutions in Hong Kong. So Hong Kong is kind of a laboratory for Beijing to learn how to dismantle, erode, and take control of these institutions and establish rule. So it is kind of a first stop for Beijing to learn to how to project its influence outside of mainland China. And after it learned its lesson about how to manipulate election, about infiltrate medias and the society and things like that, they can apply the thing that they learn in Hong Kong to other liberal society. Taiwan is definitely one of it. And some people already noticed that the Chinese strategies in establishing influence among overseas Chinese community in New Zealand, Australia, even UK, that it has some resemblance in what they have been doing in Hong Kong, even during under British colonial rule. In my book, I talk about a lot of instances in which how the CCP is already established the groundwork of United Front's influence and with elite and grassroots people and NGOs in Hong Kong getting ready for the final takeover. So these kind of tactics they have been learning that can be seen that they have been applying to other offshore society, even sovereign society in in Singapore, in New Zealand, in Australia, we see from the news that time and again, and it's very similar to what we experienced in Hong Kong before the handover.
Well, that really does suggest there is a broader relevance, and I'm sure we'll all be able to understand what's going on, you know, a lot better for having listened to you. So thank you very much, Professor.
Thank you very much.